Hello, just wanted to give you a quick heads up before this interview that this was recorded back in January before Rowan was publicly a part of Rascal, so you might notice that that's missing from this interview, but there's still a lot of great takeaways ahead, so enjoy our chat with Rowan. Thanks.
Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
This week, we're sitting down with Rowan Zeoli. Rowan is a journalist covering the tabletop industry and actual play. You can find her work in Polygon, The Fandamentals, and Autostraddle, just to name a few. Rowan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Oh, this is so nice. I'm so excited.
We're very excited to have you here.
Pumped.
Been meaning to have this one on the books for a while now.
I know, but so classically, my first dungeon people do hate journalists. It's just known.
Yeah, it is one of our core tenets.
Classic us.
So, Rowan, with these conversations, we always like to start off with kind of what our goal is, what our central questions are. And with talking to you, we would like to talk to the two Rowans that exist within you, the Rowan the actual play fan and Rowan the actual play critic. And along the way, we kind of want to get a sense of how you approach the medium as both of those things and learn a bit about where you think it's headed, should be headed, and kind of what you hope to highlight in your work. And within that, not to get a little too meta, we want to ask the question kind of throughout of, is this medium ready for critique? Which is kind of an already answered question by having you here, but it's something we'd like to get into as we go, if you'll let us do that sort of circular meta questioning.
I love that. Actual play people being meta? No, never.
No,
never.
We hate that. We hate that.
So, yeah, so let's start off with Rowan the fan. And so I guess the first question is, what was your first actual play that you came to? Like, what was your starting point?
Yeah, so the way I got into actual play and D&D in general, actually, was I was still in high school. It was my senior year of high school. I was at a after party for like a theater show because everyone involved in TTRPGs and actual play was at one point in theater. I was like also very on brand for me, very, very high, sitting on a couch, and I hear people next to me talking about D&D, specifically Critical Role. And I just like, I'd been like a closet nerd my whole life because like, you know, not really a thing that was really cool up until like 5-10 years ago. And so I was like, oh, actual, what is this? What are you talking about? And I kind of jump into it and they start telling me all about this. I'm like, oh, this sounds really, really interesting. And then I started watching Critical Role like from the beginning almost. I think it was maybe like episode 20 or 30 of the first campaign. And I was like, oh, this is magic. Like, this is crazy watching this happen, watching these people tell this story, both like improvisationally, but also like there's a clear bond between these people that is irreplicable. The, you know, friends at a table kind of thing.
The greatest lie ever told.
Yeah. They all hate each other. They all have restraining orders once they get. But that's kind of how I got into it. Then I started running my own games after like really, really diving into it and binging it, and followed it for a couple of years. Tried to get into Taz. It didn't really happen for me. Listened to God's Fall by Aram, who we all know and love. And then kind of fell off of it for a couple years and came back around during late 2019, 2020. And I started watching Dimension 20 and was like, oh, this is something different. Like, this is still actual play, but it's elevated. The performance is different. The editing style is different. The like ethos of the story that's being told is different, and the format itself is different. And all of those things appealed to me in a way that like Critical Role really appealed to my angsty teenager self. And then Dimension 20 really appealed to like, oh, this is art in a way that I didn't fully understand for a couple of years. And then started writing about it last July as like an official criticism of Dimension, the Dungeons and Drag Queens season.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We're not talking to Rowan the critic yet. We're talking to Rowan.
Sorry. Yeah, hold on. Yeah. Let me dissociate myself.
Yeah, can't talk to them yet.
I contain multitudes. I apologize.
But as you've been exposed to more and more actual plays via just like for fun and also for your job, now, so moving past Critical Role as like a starting point in Dimension 20 and God's Fall, what are the things you're actively listening to now, just as a fan?
It's good.
Also, you're not required to say my first dungeon.
No, I am going to say my first dungeon, though. That's like that's what I'm going to say. Truly, what you guys are doing is like at the forefront of the medium in like audio-borne podcasting in terms of actual play. I still love Dimension 20. I really enjoy it. Honestly, what I like, I'm not going to lie, those two are what I listen to not for work. When I'm like, oh, I just want to like listen to this for enjoyment and like to feel the magic of the medium, Dimension 20 and My First Dungeon is where I go.
Love it.
I'll take that. I'll take that all day.
Great company.
And then last question for Rowan the fan. What APs, and it sounds like Dimension 20 might be one of these, what APs have changed how you consume actual play as a fan?
As a fan? Dimension 20, certainly. Dimension 20 was the first season that I was watching it and was like, I felt the magic of it. I think Critical Role and Dimension 20 really are those two pinnacles of like engaging with these as artistic mediums. But other than that, everything else has been through the lens of work, just because that's capitalism, baby.
It's always the enemy.
So now we can talk to Rowan the critic. You can put the critic hat on. I know you've got it right there on the desk. Mirroring the first question for the fan, what was the first actual play you covered?
The first actual play I covered was Dungeons and Drag Queens, the Dimension 20 season that had a bunch of drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Amazing. And I gotta ask, what took you from Dimension 20 to small indie outfits like these two guys here?
Well, honestly, the path to actual play journalism for me was a bit strange, because I started off doing journalism, I was a stand-up comedian, and then started doing comedy journalism, and then moved from comedy journalism, where I would cover my friends who are like, I would do all these articles and interview my friends who are comedians in Brooklyn about like, how do you deal with hecklers? Like, how do you create a set? Like things like that, that were really like SEO based, but I still got to like promote people whose work I thought deserved the attention that it wasn't getting. Then I moved into doing trip sitter and doing a lot of psychedelic writing, which I still do, and harm reduction writing. And that is a little bit soul crushing when you are really just dealing with the deep depths of drug prohibition and the war on drugs and the impacts it has on real people's lives. And so I moved into writing about actual plays through Dungeons and Drag Queens. And then Charlie Hall would only pay me so much to write about Dimension 20. And then Dan Arndt actually reached out to me. We were talking on Twitter. He was talking about how Dan had done a panel with Lynn Cadega and Charlie Hall and some other reporters in the space. And I was like, oh, right. Okay, now that I'm doing this, I've like done this for Polygon, I can do this for the Fundamentals. Like, absolutely, that makes sense. And they're a volunteer-run organization, so I have a bit more freedom with what I cover and what I prioritize there. And to be real, you reached out to me, Elliot, on TikTok, and were like, hey, here's Project Echo. And I was like, oh, this sounds like a really cool game. And then I got the press kit for My First Dungeon through Dan for the Fundamentals, and saw that Chinook was on the list of producers. I was like, oh, I know Chinook from comedy. Like, we weren't really good friends. We'd only like run into each other maybe once. But I was like, oh, here's another opportunity again coming full circle, where I can like people whose work I know and respect, I can be in the position to uplift. And that's kind of how I came into going from this like lofty doing Dimension 20 into, oh, the people doing indie actual play, I can uplift them as well.
Down in the trenches.
Yeah.
Down in the trenches. In the muck.
But all of this is to kind of like set the scene of here's who you are as a fan, here's who you are as a critic. Because one of the central questions we want to ask here is, how do you, or how does anyone, approach criticism in this medium that is often hours and hours long, often requires being in like the parasociality of an actual play for a long time to really appreciate it? So I guess my first question on that regard is like, what is your approach when you are looking at a show? Like, by whatever metrics you see, what is quote unquote a good actual play versus a quote unquote bad actual play?
Intention. I think a good actual play has intention. whenever I get a press release from someone, if I get a press release from someone, I got to say, people making actual plays listening to this, please learn how to write a press release. It will make your life so much better. It will make journalists want to watch the thing you're watching, because if you put intention into your press release and be like, here is why I made this thing, here's what it's about, it's much clearer that like the product that I am going to be watching, that you're right, it's going to take hours upon hours of my life to really give it like the fair, thorough assessment that it deserves. If you can't put that effort into a press kit, how am I going to know that you are putting that into like the actual final product that you're making? And so like a good actual play has intention. I don't think you necessarily need the best equipment. I don't think you need the best actors. I think some acting training or some improv training or just an ability to riff is really needed. But you don't have to be professionally trained for it to be good. Now, great actual plays do need those things. Like the things that are pushing the medium forward, the things that are advancing, the things that I want to critique and move us towards, that is what a great actual play is made of. But I'm sure we're going to get to that later.
Well, I mean, we can get to it right now. Like when you see things that are changing the genre, this genre is already like incredibly fast moving and incredibly nebulous. It's still trying to find a real definition. What are the things you've been seeing lately that excite you, either Rowan the fan or Rowan the critic, or both?
I think the things that really excite me are seeing people experiment, are seeing people take the information and the experiments that have already been done and building upon those. Like, I think Queen's Court Games does some really interesting work. The All Night Society show that they did just won second place at the Audio Fiction World Cup. Very, very cool program. What they're doing with the form of actual play as a podcast, they have all the sound design, they have the editing, they have that like base level, but they're playing with the form in that Aaron, who is playing the narrator, has a different relationship to players than regular DMs do. He is prompting them in the same way that an omniscient narrator would prompt a character in a novel. Anyone who is playing with the forms, like you don't have, like there's a lot of budgetary limitations to doing an in-studio actual play or an in-person actual play, but utilizing the frames of the remote recording like they did in Goodia, the actual play by Nameless Domain, they really utilized those frames and like removing those frames and having the overlay as part of the narrative storytelling. So someone who is intentionally trying to tell a story and is kind of like using all of the bits of the deer to make the story happen, I think that's what makes a great actual play for me, both as a fan and as a critic, because unfortunately I am this pretentious just as a fan.
You know, you have every right to be, but I do love what you're saying about, I mean, intentionality has been in the title of like two of the 10 episodes we've released as of the time of this recording. And so I strongly agree with that sentiment.
I also love what you said about experimentation, because I think that's also what like piques my interest about different shows that come out. I'm curious, because this is something that I imagine you have to have thought about. Are there any experiments that you would like to see done in the actual place that you haven't yet? A kind of show that you would just jump at covering that doesn't exist yet? So I guess we're giving people a little bit of free Rowan Zioli ideation, but I'm curious.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't hire me as a consultant, because that will jeopardize my journalistic integrity. So take this for free. No, experiments that I really want to see, I really want to see. I know Encounter Party is trying to do this, but the way that Wizards of the Coast Entertainment One has kind of framed it has not really allowed for that to happen. And I've talked with Ned about this a bit. I think there are some elements of the show that don't particularly lean into my, because I was a book editor as well for a very long time, and my narrative structure brain is really, really strong. I want to see someone take out the parasociality of actual play and see if it works, but by telling a really incredible story. Let me see how I can phrase this properly. I really think that a lot of people hedge themselves in actual plays. Like, I think the introduction of the personalities that are going to be playing the characters prior to entering the narrative, I think we can remove that and maintain the integrity of the narrative and the experience of actual play. I don't think you have to have the, here's Brian playing this character, here's Elliot playing this character. I think you can just jump in because you don't have that in TV and film. You don't have the, here's this actor playing this character, and here's why this character, why they're perfect to play this character. Here are the choices they made into making these motivations. You just see it play out. And you're still going to have some level of parasociality in the way a novel does, in which you are able to be like, here's why I am making this choice, and here is what the motivation behind this choice is. But that's what the character is thinking, not what I, as the player, am thinking for the character. I think that is a possible thing to remove. I don't think anyone's gotten it quite right yet.
Mm. Sort of like character parasociality over person parasociality.
Exactly. Yeah. So you don't need the parasociality of the actor if you are connected to the character, if you are, you know, shipping these characters, if you're writing fan fiction. Like, that exists. People do that already.
This is a thing that I found has held true for, like, the My First Dungeon sensibility as we've been going on, is that we have been cutting out more and more of the things that happen before the start. We still definitely have it in there. I'm not saying that we're ahead of the curve, but I do find myself pulling out more and more of that. I think you see it especially in the Orbital Blues season, where we start right on the action. And it does, you know, we always had the, you know, hello and welcome to My First Dungeon, here's a recap. And finally, recently, Elliot was like, why do we have these recaps? And I was like, you know what? I don't know. Most things don't have recaps. Let's just get into the show. People will remember. They'll figure it out. Let's go.
Yeah. There's a reason Netflix has the skip recap button automatically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think another big thing, now that I'm just thinking about it, is shorter actual plays, like one-shots, film-length actual plays, because accessibility is one of the biggest barriers of entry to the new medium and as a developing medium. And I think if people were like, oh, here is a really incredibly made hour to 2 hour long story that is complete and told in a full experience, here is an introduction to the medium, I really want to see people do more of that.
I have a big thought on this, because this is a question that's been racking my mind a lot. Because for My First Dungeon, we do a lot of very short seasons. So we do 1-2 episodes. We also do, like, Orbital Blues and Yuzaeba and Die, 6-8 episode seasons. And I do not know. Like, I can look at our numbers, I get a general idea of, like, what's doing better. I do not know which is better. I could go either way. And there's a part of me that I love shorter seasons, and I love being able to play more games. I love being able to tell more concise stories, and I like that accessibility aspect. But me as a fan, when I see a 6-episode season of Dimension 20, I'm less excited than the 22-episode season of Dimension 20. And I can't quite figure out what it is I want. Because I agree with you. I love making things shorter, making things more accessible and more bite-sized, and a better chance for me to get into it. I want.
Well, I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking about you, Brian. You are in it. You are lost in the sauce of actual play already.
That's true. I'm a bad test case.
I'm talking about, like, I showed my boyfriend Max your Project Echo season. The one episode, just here is what actual play is outside of Dimension 20. And he was like, oh, I get it now. And that's more of what I'm wanting. I'm wanting people who put the same level of production, so I can show someone who has no idea what this medium is, so I can go to an editor of, like, a larger publication, if I can bring it to, like, a Slate, or if I can bring it to, like, insert big culture publication of your choosing, and go, here is an hour-long thing that I can write a whole really in-depth cultural piece about, and get a bunch of people to learn that actual play is a real medium that they can dive into.
But do you think that that exists just as a really great entry point? Or do you think that that format could exist for longer? I guess basically my question is, it's a great entry point for someone to have an hour experience, but then is the next thing that they listen to another thing from that same group? Basically, like, do you listen to another season of My First Dungeon? Or now that you have been introduced to it, now you understand it, now you go to Critical Role, now you go to Dimension 20, now you go to something that has more meat per season.
I don't think I would wish upon my worst enemy to go, hey, watch an hour-long thing, now go watch Critical Role.
Go to Critical Role. Start from episode 1 of Critical Role. Woof.
Wait, I think there's something interesting here, Brian, about TVs and movies. TV and movies and these two kinds of actual play, where, like, I'm forming the thought as I'm saying this, but it's like seeing a really good movie doesn't preclude me from wanting to watch a really good TV show and vice versa. Like those are two things of the same medium of like recorded visual entertainment.
You know what it maybe is? And maybe it's that there, to my opinion, in my opinion, there have been a lot of great actual play TV shows, or like in this analogy, actual play TV shows. I have not personally seen a lot of great actual play movies.
Rowan just talked about one, our Project Echo season.
Well, I can't possibly be
Goodia is also a great example. Goodia is a two shot.
I know, I need to watch that.
You got it. It's great. And Dr. M. Friedman, who you've also had on the podcast, calls it the ambitious middle of actual play. And I think that's a really great term.
Oh, we're getting to that. Ooh, don't you
ooh,
worry.
Hell yeah. Amazing. But yeah, no, I think that's a really great point, Elliot. I think that they don't preclude each other. And I think they're also inherently different storytelling mediums. Like an hour long, 2 hour long, even 4 hour long actual play is really, really highly honed and condensed and packs a lot of emotional punch or comedy or whatever genre you're playing in, but it develops it really, really quickly and there is no time wasted. Whereas an episodic thing, you're focusing more on the people that you're with, you're developing that parasociality a bit more, where you don't have the ability to develop that parasociality in a much more condensed form.
Yeah, you're making me wonder if there's like an era of blockbuster actual play movies kind of coming. Like I'm connecting the fact that like we have these big tours coming up of like Dimension 20 Live and NADPOD at Carnegie Hall just happened and Critical Role sold out.
Wembley Stadium.
Wembley.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. And like, these are like blockbuster events and I think by their nature are inherently one shots. And I'm just wondering if like that's a thing that's coming. If like we're, if like there will be blockbuster actual play releases, like even in a movie, like with video actual play, you could even put it in a theater in like a limited run.
The thing is though, so far all of the live shows, and not to their detriment or not to as a negative, but so far all the live shows have either been continuations of main campaigns or
have they?
Mm-hmm. Or like fan service.
Yeah,
things,
one-offs.
Which,
yeah.
Which isn't bad. It's just okay, Critical Role in Dimension 20 could do this, but would it be as successful if they came in and said, we're going to do a live one-off season, essentially. We're going to sit here for 4 hours. We're going to tell a complete story with new characters you've never heard of before. Would it work? Obviously, Dimension 20 and Critical Role, you'd get the butts in the seats and everyone would have a good time. But would it be as successful as what they're doing with long-form campaigns? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing that I think is, when I've noticed a lot of these experiments have been happening, I think a lot of the reason why a lot of experiments haven't taken off in the way that many of us would like them to is because they're trying to do too many new things at once. Like, they're trying to either remove the parasociality or they're trying to do a different kind of storytelling. They're trying to change so many things at the same time because they're not including familiar faces from the actual play scene, or they're trying to set themselves apart in some way. If you're going to be introducing something new to people, they also need to have something familiar. So I think Dimension 20 would actually be the perfect place to experiment this, to be like, okay, hey, like, let me get Sam Reich on the phone right now. Just be like, hey, bud, take some of the best actual play performers in the entire world. Don't have, like, maybe even take Brennan out of it. Make people, just some faces people know. Have a really concise, really tight story that happens without any of the parasociality beforehand. You know, we're kind of talking in circles. We're kind of like, we're just circling the drain a little bit, right?
There is also something, I don't want to get too lost into terminology because we could, and I'm sure we will at some point talking about actual play, especially on this show. But the term of one shot has kind of become, it's a very cool term. It feels very gamey, but it does kind of signal to me anytime I hear it of like, oh, we're going to make goof characters. We're going to do a fun thing. This is going to, we're going to go wild and crazy. I don't have to care. Like we're doing the, you know, Soul Calibur one shot. You know, Critical Role sponsored by Soul Calibur.
The Wendy's.
yeah, show the me Wendy's the one shot one. That makes me cry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, those are all they're all cool and they're all good in their own way, but nothing has... I've been trying to find the word for this
because I've had the same feeling, like one shot, especially if I'm trying to appeal to entertainment editors, if I'm trying to appeal to the masses who are like, what the fuck's a one shot? Like a feature length actual play. Like
something which would still be 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly. But still, and I feel like people are actually much more willing to do a 4 hour actual play than a 4 hour film.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Could be two though.
Could be two. You could do it.
Right. Depending on the game.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then that is, and I'm just like, my producer brain is going and I'm like, okay, I know what 2 hours feels like. And I know what we can get done in 2 hours. And that does require the axing of all of that fluff at the beginning. Like you got to start in the story because of time.
Oh, you mean like a book or a TV show where you have to start.
Yeah. In medias res, baby.
I think something that's also really interesting about this is how much back work you have to do. Like you have to have your characters so thoroughly developed and your world so thoroughly developed that once you get into playing, there is no question about who these people are, what they're doing. You don't have time to figure out what the story is. You know what the story you're telling is the moment you hit record.
Yeah. Less emergent storytelling, which, you know, not for nothing is some of the magic of actual play as it exists for me, at least.
Absolutely.
And like as a performer and as a producer, like some of the things I love most about it are the emergent storytelling. But yeah, for this style we're talking about, you need to know that shit in and out.
I don't know how much. I think you'd still have a lot of emergent story because I think what you'd come in with is you'd have the world and the characters like set, and you'd probably know the starting point, and then it's like. And then it's like a good improv show or like improvised Shakespeare. It's like there's still a lot to be discovered.
I guess emergent character more than emergent story is the thought. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Rom-com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom, or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Annie Award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
So, Rowan, you said something in there that is right out of our outline, because we had a wonderful conversation with your friend and ours, Dr. Emily Friedman, the preeminent academic of actual play. And M. Friedman uses this term, the ambitious middle, which we love and we find super interesting. And obviously, we got M's take on this. I want to get your take on what are the elements that define an ambitious middle production for you?
Intense artistic intention and no money.
And no money. Oh, you make it sound so glamorous.
I feel personally victimized by that definition.
But like, for real though, like if you guys had the budget of a Dimension 20, the stuff you'd be making is crazy. But that's just not where you're at right now. I do think eventually that'll be where you're at. I don't think that's where anyone except for 0.001% of actual play people are at right now. And so I really think with intention, artistry, and a limited budget, people have made incredible shit. Like, people have just, in every medium, that's just true of every single medium that has ever existed. And it really pushes people to try and break the bounds of working within the limitations that they have. And that's what I think makes an ambitious middle for me. Like, using the remote recorder, like I was talking about before, using the screens of the remote recording, using the overlay, using the edits of that to tell the story itself. Again, Queen's Court Games, I'm watching through Mekong right now. It's their mech season. And they use the little screens as little things of the mech. And I'm like, that's brilliant. That's so smart.
It's all these, like, these little things that'll... And honestly, that is... I'm going to keep circling back to this idea of like movie...
Can't help yourself.
Actual play movies, because it's going to be stuck in the craw. But by doing those interesting things production value wise, like by using, for us, it's like sound design and music. But for a video AP, it's like using the screens and the overlay. That can be a thing that cuts out that fluff at the beginning. When you have really good, if you're in a visual medium, like if you're doing a video actual play and you use the visual aspect to its best extent, all of a sudden you don't need a lot more words at the start.
Exactly.
I mean, it's the classic show, don't tell.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. And it's like the character themes from Behold in our seasons. Those are character-defining sound that we then don't have to say as explicitly.
Exactly, yeah. And we can play those up and hold those back, and you get a better sense of whose scene it is, even if you're not really actively hearing it. Those decisions, as you make more and more and more and more and more of them, they add up to something significant, to something substantial.
They create a world. They create the immersive experience that is referred to as narrative transport. I don't know if you guys know what that is.
Oh, no. That's a good word. That's a good phrase.
So narrative transport is the psychological phenomenon in which when you are listening to a story being told, your brain registers those memories of the story as if they were experiences that had happened to you. Similarly, also, when you're listening to someone tell a story, your brainwaves match up with theirs, which is really crazy. But like, so losing yourself in that story, and that's where like the therapeutic value of actual play and the therapeutic of narrative and tabletop games in general, that's where it all comes from, is this ability to like have like an ego death experience almost of losing yourself within the narrative.
It's mind control, baby. It's mind control.
You said a couple trigger words that are bringing me to this question of, I'm curious, you mentioned this at the beginning, your work covering psychedelics, and I want to get into some of your other work as well, but maybe start there. How does your work covering psychedelics inform how you approach actual play?
Oh, for sure it does. I think storytelling is magic. Like, fundamentally at its core, I think there is something truly magical about the ability to emotionally impact someone who you do not know through telling something that does not exist. And so my psychedelic writing has really allowed me like cut my teeth in journalism and really allowed me to understand what journalistic writing is. But it's also allowed me to kind of take a step back and look at what niche countercultural movements and experiences say about a larger, more human experience. And I think there's a lot of overlap between the psychedelic communities and the actual play and TTRPG community in general. I think there is a lot of like progressive ideology that's overlapping. I think there's a lot of organizing capability that's overlapping. But like, really, when you get down to it, okay, so you're sitting down with a bunch of people in a magic circle where one person is facilitating and guiding or maybe trip-sitting you through an augmented reality experience where you no longer become yourself, experience lifetimes upon lifetimes of other people, and then you are fundamentally changed as a person after they happen. And you need safety tools and you need the proper set and setting. Otherwise, someone could be significantly traumatized by the experience that has happened. That's psychedelics and TTRPGs at the same time.
Wild. I'm going to quote you back to you because I think this connects. When you covered Mentopolis, I loved this sentence you said. The framing of Mentopolis also forces viewers to reflect on how we relate to these various internal parts of our own minds and who benefits from our self-suppression of those voices.
Mm. Great. Great line.
Great line.
Great line.
Great line. Who wrote it? Yeah.
Walther.
But I think that kind of connects to what you're saying of this, like, this by experiencing and unlocking those parts of your mind in both of these worlds, you are releasing yourself from the self-suppression of those voices. So I love that.
Yeah.
This also gets back to the idea of what makes the ambitious middle, or like the active intention of that. If that's the goal, you've got to get past the activation energy that is required to get you to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only made harder if there's fluff at the beginning, or if the sound is bad, or these are things that are obstacles to be overcome so that you can get to that point and have that transcendent experience. And the more you actively think about the things that are in your way, the easier you can solve those problems and get to that point.
Exactly. Like if your goal and intentionality is to provide a specific experience, which is really what my work was as a book editor, was really like, okay, what does this author want to be doing? What is it that they are attempting to doing? And what is getting in the way of them actually being able to communicate that? How can I help them figure out how to better provide that experience, whether it's on like a line by line, page by page level, where it's like, okay, you need to alter these sentence structures, you need to alter the word choice that you're having, you need to highlight and focus on different details, or on like a full book structure, like are these scenes and are these moments taking away from the overall pacing of the story? Like thinking on that macro level and that micro level is what turns something from good to great.
And I think we're kind of moving into even more of our central question, or one of our central questions of, is this medium ready for like capital C criticism? Because in the same way that an editor is basically a critic that's just on your side, there is a prevailing sentiment that this is such a nascent art form that we are still in the space where you kind of want to have rising tide raises all boats, like only noting positive things. But in the same way that you need an editor to point out like, hey, this isn't working, maybe you should do it this way, I am of the opinion that like negative criticism in the space at large would be good for the medium. And you're one of the few people who is actively engaging in tabletop role-playing game criticism, and actual play criticism. So I'm curious what your opinion is on this topic. I think I already know your opinion, but I still want to get your full thoughts on it.
Well, so I think actually that's a really great point, the connection between like being a book editor as a critic who's on your side. I am on the side of the medium. I am on the side of making it so that way more people come to the medium. The people who are making stuff in this medium get their due diligence and their flowers. But I also want to let people know that they're doing better. Like if like a friend who tells you that you're doing everything right all the time is not actually your friend. Like someone who will like tell you like, hey, you're fucking up. Hey, you need to change some shit. That's how you know you actually have a real friend who cares about your well-being in the long term, rather than just like trauma responding and appeasing any kind of negative reaction from you. And so my specialty, I think, as a book editor, and the feedback I got from people as a book editor, was that I was always incredibly supportive in being like, I love what you're doing here. I think these are amazing things that you're doing. Here's what makes your story special and why you need to be the person telling it. Let's figure out how to make that better. It makes it a little bit different when you're on the back end. It's already a produced product and it is out in the world and you're not doing it privately behind closed doors of like, here's what you have to do beforehand. I think a lot of actual play could benefit from having like editors in that kind of way, because obviously you guys don't really have not just like the timing or the capability or the funds, but like you just don't have someone to be able to come in and look at it with that objective eye. You are so lost and in the experience of making the actual play that you don't really get to have that outside view. Being a critic, my responsibility in this nascent medium really feels like I have to be a cheerleader, but also be like, hey, collectively, I'm not going to be like, this person did this thing wrong. But like with Mekong, I think that's a really perfect example. I think Mekong could have cut out the first 6 minutes of their show because they didn't need those introductions. When they got into the story proper, it was amazing. It was great. I don't think they could have just cut out that introduction. I think Dimension 20 is a really great place to start doing like genuine, like artistic criticism, because I wanted to write a whole piece on Burrow's End. My life got really hectic for a lot of reasons that I am legally unallowed to disclose.
We'll spill the tea at a later date.
At a later date. But Dimension 20's Burrow's End, I think, is generally one of the best seasons of actual play. I think one of the best pieces of actual play art that has ever been created thus far. The story that they told was immaculate without relying on the parasociality of like, oh, we love Brennan, we love Siobhan, we love Izzy, we love Rashawn, we love Jasper, we love Abria. We didn't need to have that. And I think they actually undercut themselves in a lot of moments by being like, oh, look how great we are at what we're doing. Like, we're amazing at this. Like, Abria, you're so good at DMing. Oh my God, Jasper, that was an amazing moment. Brennan, that was a great monologue. We all know. We all know how talented these people are. That's why they're where they are. And so if that was removed from it, you don't get pulled out of the immersive experience of watching this show, of watching this piece of art. And I think that's where we can start criticism, is by punching up, quote unquote.
There is something to be said too, that this medium is tough to edit in general, mm-hmm. or like, because ultimately, like, even us, and we edit a lot, but once you record something, that's kind of what you got. I mean,
it's more development than editing, I feel like, what we're talking about in this world.
Yeah. And it is also like, you know, just like a good sauce, it is reducing the sauce to make it more rich.
Mm-hmm.
It is cutting out the unnecessary to make what is left more vibrant and more potent.
Brian Flaherty, the food metaphor.
The food. That was Brian David Yudkins. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
I'll get my flowers where it's due.
Yeah, but I think it is. I think that the process that we're talking about in this world is a robust development in the before you hit record, you know, and in some ways, an actual play development is tied into like a little bit of session zero. But I think that one of the things that I know we're thinking about a lot going into this year, Brian, is like, we really think about the kind of story that we're going to tell, and like, who we're thinking really intentionally about cast and all that. And that's not to say other people aren't doing that, but I think these are the conversations you have like in that sort of like book editing moment equivalent that are great. And I'm glad we do it. And I think we do it well, but I think it's interesting to imagine a world where you could be a development person in this medium in the way that there are development people in TV, people who are developing TV shows before they then get sold and like staff a writer's room. If you could have people that go into different actual play productions and are like, I'm going to help you get ready to make the best product you can before you ever hit record.
And that's like what C does on Transplanar. Connie's partner C is the dramaturg for Transplanar. And so like, that's the role of a dramaturg in theater. Bringing that over into actual play is the closest we have to like a developmental editor for books in actual play. And so making that practice a lot more standard, I think, is really important, because that is an ongoing practice as well. Like, you are meeting with the actors and being like, hey, so you made these choices. What does that choice mean for the implications of where your character is? What does it mean for the implications of what the world is happening with? And how can I communicate that intention to the GM, so that way we can highlight that intention more and make it even more present moving forward.
Yeah, Transplanar's doing a lot of cool stuff with that intentionality of like prepping their players and their GM, is what I understand.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Absolutely.
There is, because I know someone out there is thinking at this point of like, the more you do of that, the further you're getting away from what is considered actual play now. Like, the more you're figuring out stuff in between sessions, the more you're planning out beats or characters, it's like, okay, we're getting much, much closer to improvised narrative or
scripted narrative.
Or scripted narrative.
Taking steps towards, yeah.
I don't necessarily have a question or comment to that, but it's just like, it is a line you're writing.
I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive ideas. I think the idea that like actual play has to become a monolith, it has to become one thing, that I want to make sure that's clear. Like, that's not what I'm saying. That's not my goal with actual play, because I think the thing that is beautiful about actual play and the thing that's like beautiful about film and TV and any artistic medium is there are so many subgenres within a medium. Like, there is the actual play that is much more focused on narrative, that some people decide to call it narrative play. And then that's a whole thing. You can go back to listen to another podcast episode.
Don't get yourself in trouble.
But then there's the other side of it, which is like educational actual play, which has no other intention but to be teaching how the game is played while the narrative is kind of like this secondary effect. And so I think both of those things are equally valuable and serve different roles within the space. And so then you, those are not, that's not a binary, that's a sliding scale. And so you can have as much prep as you want. I think my intentionality and my reasoning for wanting more intentionality is to make the medium more accessible. Because I think there are always going to be people who love just watching people sit down at a table and goof off and just have a bunch of friends and enjoy that social experience or parasocial experience. But I think there are also a lot of people who are as pretentious as me who want really, really artistic things, like want to push an art, a piece of art to its limits. And all of that can exist together. And I think the more that all of that exists, the better off we all are.
And I think it's, I think it is a problem. I don't want to say a problem. I think it's kind of a problem of like audience education a little bit. Because if I say I'm going to go to a movie, you everyone inherently understands that, like, I could be meaning let's go to AMC 25 on 42nd and see the, you know, next big Avengers movie. Or I could be saying let's go to Film Forum and see a French movie from 1963. And, like, you know, everyone understands there's the new wave and there's mainstream cinema and there's Dogma 95 and there's Werner Herzog and there's, you know, Japanese cinema. And then everyone inherently understands that in the same way that you have like different genres of music. But that's not necessarily true yet with actual play. It's kind of seen as that, it's seen as Critical Role, it's seen as Dimension 20, even though those are very different things, it's still kind of, it's a slowly crumbling monolith.
We also have the problem of the fact that TTRPGs have their own definition problem that happens where we can't shake the definition of D&D. I know, Rowan, you just tweeted at time of recording today asking, how do you explain, how do you get somebody who's never played a TTRPG before to play a TTRPG? And the tricky thing about actual play is that, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, you're also asking somebody to understand the medium of play that made the story, which is also a thing that is difficult to get audiences in on. So you're like doing twofold level of getting the audience involved, which, like, coming from the game design world, I know is already a challenge on just the, like, getting people to understand a TTRPG thing. And it's like, but also, what if we then use this thing you don't understand to tell a story and you listen to that instead of watching a movie?
Exactly.
You know what I was saying about, like, activation energy and static friction you've got to overcome? That's a lot of it right there. That's a lot of it. Huge, huge ask for someone coming out of note. Like, really, honestly, right now, if you love actual plays, think of how you would explain it to your grandmother.
And that's why I think it's so important, circling back to this same thought, of having a feature-length actual play, of being like, hey, I don't need to explain what the fuck is going on to you. I can tell you, hey, here's what this story is about. Go watch it.
I feel like we've gotten close on Project Deco, and I think...
the Anamnesis one.
Breakfast.
Oh, Yuzabe's been
and
Breakfast.
And Anamnesis,
absolutely.
For sure. I mean, I guess Yuzabe's is more like a serial series, but it's still kind of...
audio cartoon,
that.
Even?
It's an audio cartoon, you might say.
I want to poke at that a little bit. So we had, again, M. Friedman on, and we tried to get M to on mic come up with some new terms with us, mm-hmm. and M, ever the academic, does not want to jump into those things.
I love that I'm not an academic.
Yeah. Don't we all? No offense, M. We were struck by, and we love this, that when you covered the Yuzabe season, you threw out this term audio cartoon, and we love it. We think it is very good and accurate.
We wish we had it for our press kit beforehand.
We wish we had had it for our press kit beforehand. I'm curious how you think about terminology when you're approaching things as a critic, and when you take a moment to choose to kind of create a piece of terminology like that, how that is part of your process or way of thinking about this.
So it absolutely is a huge part of my process. The reason why I have stuck so firmly to actual play, especially at like M's recommendation a little bit, not even directly, but like indirectly through the podcasts that she's spoken with y'all, is very much this idea that like, it's like we were saying, it's hard enough as it is to get people to understand what the fuck we're talking about in the first place. If we can just have a succinct word that says what it is on the tin, you know, dead dove, do not eat. Like if that is right there.
Is that a reference to something?
It's Arrested Development. Goes into the freezer, pulls out the bag. It says Dead Dove.
I don't know what I expected. I remember this. Okay.
That
fucked me up for a second. I wasn't ready for whatever really that was. Okay. I'm sorry. Please continue.
But Dead Dove Do Not Eat. You know, it's exactly what it is. It says what it is on the tin. Actual play, you're a little bit murky there. Audio cartoon, you know exactly where you're at. You know exactly what an audio cartoon is. And then you can work backwards and be like, oh, this is an audio cartoon that is an actual play of Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. And like accessibility and getting people in the door is where I go, okay, where can I coin a phrase, or if I can find a phrase anywhere to be like, how can I convey this information as succinctly and clearly as possible?
So, okay, I'm gonna challenge you on this a little bit, or not challenge your idea, but challenge you to think of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at something like Goodya, which is a two shot, is there a way that you would define that other than actual play? Like, is there a I'm trying to come back to that idea of like, if we have a feature length actual play, what, I don't know, is there another term that we can start with to get the people who don't know anything in the door and then immediately say, this is a feature-length actual play of this game?
So this is actually something I thought a lot about. I actually have an interview with the people from Goodya coming out, and I just went with limited series because that's a language people understand. I did reference two-shot in the article at some point because I think there's also a like elitist aspect to removing the historical language of one shot, two shot from it, being like to disregard the tradition would be problematic in its own right. So making sure that those exist side by side is important, but being like, yes, this is a limited series actual play is the best I've come up with thus far. And then like focusing it really as like a character study. Like if I would describe it to someone, it is a character study of Bluebeard's Bride through a South Asian lens.
Mm. All right, I got a pitch for you.
Go for it.
Podbuster.
Get out.
I'm going to hang up.
I will see myself
absolutely
out.
Absolutely leave.
I will see myself out. Thank you,
absolutely
everybody.
Not. I'm going to keep
Brian,
that in.
I'm going to
play that twice. So you're going to have to listen to this.
I'm editing
this.
I'll keep it in. I'll do it. I'll keep it in. I'm not ashamed. I'm not afraid.
You've got to add a boom, and you got to hear the silence that comes after it. Yeah. I'm, you know what? I'm going to come in. I'm going to sound design just how many crickets there were. No, I don't mind Podbuster, honestly.
Describe what. What does it mean?
It's podcast plus blog plus blockbuster.
Oh,
I thought that was
Pod. Oh, okay.
Classic portmanteau.
Yeah, classic portmanteau.
Classic portmanteau.
I feel like other people might use Podbuster, but I feel like it might mean something completely different. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, now we're. Yeah, you're not wrong.
Classic My First Dungeon raunchy humor.
The classic My First Dungeon raunchy humor.
There is a podcasting company called Q Code, which people might be familiar with. They take like big name Hollywood actors and they put them into like limited series audio dramas or comedies, and they have the intention of trying to sell the rights to movie companies and stuff. But they often pitch their things as like audio films or audio movies, and they try to couch it in that vocabulary.
Yeah, movies for your ears.
Movies for your ears, yeah, to varying degrees of success. But it's something interesting.
Anyway, I'm gonna pull us back onto the rails after I did what I did.
After you pod busted us.
After I pod busted.
You pod busted all over this.
So I love, Rowan, that you brought up this that you talked to Dan after this panel that he did with Lynn, which I actually got to attend at Gen Con, if it's the panel that
yes,
I'm
thinking
of.
Yes, it is that
of.
Panel. Yeah.
And I asked this question to the panel, and I'm going to ask it to you. And I want to understand how you parse the responsibilities that you have as a critic to the audience, to creators, to yourself, and to like the publication and more, if there are more.
It's a very interesting question because like parsing the responsibility, I think all the responsibilities are the same responsibility. I think the responsibility is to be honest and to be in good faith and to try and maintain a level of trust and integrity. Like, I don't think there is a differentiation between those responsibilities, because I think once you start saying that there is a differentiation between those responsibilities, then you are getting into different roles, because the role of a journalist and a critic is the same role anywhere you position it.
That's a great answer. I like it.
That's the answer I was looking for.
That's what I was looking for. Well done. Brian, is there anything you want to dig into before we go into these last couple of questions? Anything you want to circle back to?
I could pick at this movie-length actual play thing all day, because it's truly been needling at my head, because we exist somewhere between the two, and we have yet to really pick a side. And I think we're doing a little bit of both. And I think that's valid to do, like, both series and movies. Like, you know, a lot of studios do that. But it is a difference in mindset that I'm struggling with as a producer of, like, how do you come at those differently? How do you approach those differently? And what should you be focusing on when you're in one mindset or the other?
I was actually, again, talking about this with Ned Donovan, like, very, very recently, about how to make this happen and how that would work. And I really think that just everyone going in has to be on the same page. Like, if everyone has the same level of awareness and collective understanding and cooperation as the GM has to have all the time, that, like, okay, we are going in telling this exact, not this exact story, but this type of story. We all know exactly why we're here. We're not going to throw in the random jokes. We're not going to throw it off the rails. Because, like, those are impulses that you can indulge in longer shows. But if everyone's going in being like, okay, no, we know that we cannot, we know that we have to do this. If everyone's on the same page, I think it gets a lot easier.
Yeah, because we've got a session zero coming up on this Sunday. And now I'm just actually thinking, like, for a shorter season, for, like, what will likely be a two shot. And it's like, how do I come into that with that intentionality?
So I'm going to do some free consulting work right now.
Yeah, go for it.
So I think the thing that you really have to do is really nail down what themes you are tackling within the story and how the characters, what is defined as the third rail emotionally. This theory comes from a book called Story Genius by Lisa Kron, where every aspect of a story has to reflect the internal emotional third rail of the characters. And so it has to challenge, affirm, or confront that worldview. And if it does not do one of those three things, it shouldn't be in a story.
Now we got to figure out what that third rail is. I'll let you know.
I'm excited.
We'll cycle back to this.
I'm excited. It'll be fun.
Actually, Rowan, do you have anything else you wanted to circle back to before we...
Yeah, the last thing I think, actually, is I think the way forward for actual play as a medium at large is more collectives, is more people working together rather than individual studios trying to do things on their own. Because I think the model that a lot of people are trying to come at actual play creation is like, we are going to make our projects, we're going to focus on ourselves and move forward in that way. That works. But I do think that stunts growth in the long run, because it is an inherently, like, capitalistic view. It's inherently like, I am doing this for myself and I am doing this to make sure that my project works. I think the collectivization of resources to a degree of being like, okay, here are other people in the space who are doing some really incredible work, who care about it as much as I do. We are going to come together and make these things together with all of our collective resources. It is less of a drain on each of us individually and easier for people to discover and find us if we are in these larger groups. And so this, again, I was talking to Ned about this. We were trying to figure out, like, what is the future of actual play? How do you make money here? Because I think that's a huge thing that people don't really understand. And that's what I think my job as a critic is to get people with money to pay attention to the art form. Figuring out that of how to make money together instead of how to make money individually is going to be the way forward for the art form.
And I guess, who do you see doing that? Who do you think is succeeding in that right now? Or who is making the steps towards it?
Is anyone succeeding in it? I'm not sure, because no one's really making money. I think you guys are doing a really great job in what you are doing and the sponsorships that you are getting. I think like Eric Silver's podcast network, Multitude, I think that's a really interesting structure. I think kind of using different ideas of what success is, as opposed to just like isolating yourself and driving forward and nose to the grindstone. I think that is, this is going to be maybe a hot take. I think that's a trauma response to capitalism that a lot of artists have.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I think finding ways to work together and finding ways to collaborate and make money in that way together is, for right now, one of the only ways to do it until we can convince middle-aged liberals with money to give us money.
I was telling Brian we need to go on Fresh Air. So, you know.
There you go. You got it.
Say we get on Fresh Air, we're set.
Yeah, that's how we get those middle-aged liberals money.
Exactly. That's what I think Encounter Party is doing very well, though. I think Encounter Party's main demographic is the TBS NCIS marathon watchers. And getting outside of ourselves a little bit and trying to appeal to audiences that are outside of our niche is the only way we're going to make this medium continue for another 20, 30 years.
I do love what Ned and Counterparty are doing. And I think to what degree they're successful in removing parasociality still remains to be seen. But I think they are, in my opinion, probably the closest.
Absolutely.
They're really going for it. And I know when I watch that show, I am not seeing the actors. Like, I know the names of the characters better than I know the names of the actors. And I care more about the characters than I care more about the experience of the performers. So it, at least for me, their venture is succeeding.
Absolutely. I also think, though, the thing that I told Ned, and I've told him this real honestly, I was like, hey, you opened with a dream sequence. That's like rule number one you don't do in fiction writing. You're trying to tell a fiction story and you opened with a dream? Come on.
Oh, that's such an interesting bit of, like, are we destined to fall into all sorts of narrative traps that other mediums have worked out?
That we just haven't gotten to yet?
That we just, like, that actual play just hasn't gotten to? I'm thinking of, like, the show something crazy and then cut to 3 days earlier, like, a film trope. Like, are we just destined to make all the same?
Well, I think that's what Ned's intention was with it. I think Ned was very much like, we're trying to do a thing in actual play that hasn't been done. We're trying to call our shot and be like, this is where the story is going. I personally had a difficult time reading that from the first episode. But again, I didn't sell a show to Wizards of the Coast. So, like, fuck me, yeah. Right?
Yeah. I think with that, we'll take to our final question. Rowan Zioli, what are you bringing to the table today? This could be a person, a game, a show, a resource, anything within tabletop or without tabletop that you would recommend to our listeners right now.
I have mentioned a bunch of shows throughout this episode that I think everyone should go watch. Another great show, Replay by Aram of Dead Ghost Productions. Really, really
Absolutely.
Great show. Fantastic. However, in the vein of the conversation that we've been having, if you are a GM of an actual play and you want to learn more about story structure, read Story Genius by Lisa Cron and Story Grid. Those two books are the most important texts for me in learning how to understand story structure on a deep, like, intuitive level. And I think the more you understand intuitively how stories work, the better you are able to perform them in improv.
And again, that's just another step towards intentionality. Like, everyone can passively watch shows and television and pick up on story structure, but by actually choosing to study it, again, another step that will add to the mountain of things that will slowly make for a great and innovative show.
Thank you, Rowan Zioli, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you?
Absolutely. You can find me literally anywhere at Rowan Zioli. It's a great name because I chose it and no one else has it.
Incredible. And keep an eye out for more of Rowan's work in the coming months. We're very excited to read more of her great words.
And if you want more gaming content, check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. Those are both linked in our show notes below. Rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcast. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye, everybody.
Bye.